Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
Listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I am in studio once again with Sabina Hasseni and Stefan Hostetter, and I didn't even pause to ask her if I got her last name right this week, but I did see a nod in my furful. We're going to be talking largely about, well, here's the thing. We tried really hard, pretty hard, to not talk about Trump this week, but so that actually kind of makes the theme of this week how you can't not talk about Trump. I chose a couple of technology related stories and corporate related stories just generally, as did my colleagues. So in an attempt to like phase in the Trump, we do have to do 4 years of this. We will have to pace ourselves. That being said, not a single one of these stories cannot be related directly to Trump. So I'm going to go second, as in the middle of the program. Sabina is going to go third. And first, we're going to hear from Stefan. All of these are generally technology, economy, state of the world stories. And of course, you'll be ready for it. We'll have to talk about Trump. Stefan, take it away.
Thank you. That actually is an excellent basis to begin this story, mainly because of the fact that I actually plan on this is going to be part two of our 208-part series of Resisting Trump. However, neither story actually is related to Trump, as you mentioned. So the first one is a pretty simple one. And I think it's the one that sort of could not be not talked about this week, especially in Canada, is that our government and Mr. Trudeau specifically has gone back on their plan to promoted plan, actually, to have our last election as the last election under first past the post. This week they came out, the newly installed Democratic Institutions Minister, Karina Gould, on Wednesday to explain why the government, is giving up on this. And if you've been following this, it's funny. It's one of those things where it's like you keep trying. People kept trying to give them the benefit of the doubt that they're going to do it. People kept trying to give them the benefit that they're going to do it. And then at some point along the – but they sort of – every once in a while there's a little bit of a hint that they weren't. I think one of the biggest hints was their much mocked sort of what kind of voting system do you want personality quiz. Which was perhaps one of the – as an interesting tactic as engagement as it was, it really failed in terms of – it never actually asked the question, what kind of voting system would you want? Instead, asked a bunch of random other questions and never really got to the point, which of course allowed them to then make this statement. So when they came out to explain why they weren't going to do anything on voting reform, at least in the time being – they claimed that, quote, it has become evident that the broad support needed among Canadians for a change of this magnitude does not exist. And that's a quote from the Democratic Institutions Minister, Karina Gould. And this, of course, is sort of the lead up to what was expected. It's a funny little thing in which there was all this conversation about, well, the Liberals really wanted one thing. The Conservatives really wanted one thing, and the NDP really wanted one thing. And so when they brought that sort of – when Liberals went out and brought together those three different – sorry, they even had May on it, actually. They had four or five governing parties all together in that in the sort of committee to decide on what we should do. There was clearly – everyone sort of figured out which lines they were going to fight on, and then the question was, well, what do we do about it? And – interestingly, and then when they came out with a general recommendation, the committee actually came out with a somewhat reasonable recommendation of moving forward on this topic. The Liberals once again said, "Oh, there wasn't consensus," and so Liberals have been sort of repeating this lack of consensus thing, which of course is kind of silly, in part because they could have always just gone the conservative option. They could have always just sided with the conservatives and thrown it out to a referendum and let Canadians decide.
May I just also point out that when you have two wolves and a sheep trying to decide what's for dinner, you also have trouble finding consensus.
But yeah, like I think the interesting thing here is, you know, the Liberals very clearly would have preferred a sort of a ranked ballot system because, you know, they are many people's second choice. The conservatives most conservatives at least, there's a few conservative candidates outside of this forum, but most conservatives were pretty happy with first past the post because it's really the only way that they'll ever win a majority. It seems they can't seem to get beyond 35-40% with most of their policies, so I don't actually see us getting beyond that. And then the final one is and then the NDP were obviously looking for a proportional representation, because proportional representation would probably, you know, again, if we're just playing what works better for each party game here, would have given them more consistently the balance of power. So all three had their sort of dogs in this race. And the Liberals, to some extent, have just capitulated to the Conservatives. And again, the Liberals also benefited from first past the post, in that, you know, they only won, I think there's a great I think it was a Beaverton article, but I forget which exactly one, which was that Trudeau defends plan by saying only 39% of people voted for electoral change, referring to the fact that they only got 39% of the vote. And I think that sort of speaks to the silliness of all this. And so it's, again, we'll see what's up next. We're probably looking at, you know, I don't really see, I'm not too, we had a moment, and the moment still exists. And so the reason why I introduced this as an opportunity to respond to Trump, is that the first past the post system is unquestionably the one that most consolidates power. And unquestionably gives the most likely rise to a Trump-like figure. Because it, you know, the way Trump won was that he consolidated his base, and then he manufactured that base into victory. And despite the fact that he's, you know, remains even now below 50% approval rating, and so this first past the post system allows you to, as far as all the other options, ranked ballot theoretically could do a similar thing, but at least then you have a little bit more choice. But proportional representation is the way to avoid this.
Yeah, I think we just need to acknowledge here, this is a good time to acknowledge two obvious truths, Devin. First obvious truth is the majority of Canadians in reality, I regardless of what they say, I think don't actually want a fair system. They want a system that benefits the people they like. I think that's hard to argue.
So
aside from what they'll say, I'm saying this is what's actually in their motivation. So, and the second one, and I'll just throw off on this, is that if we have a political system that we're saying is broken to elect people, using that elected system to change a system into one that is fair and not simply the one that suits the party that takes that swing at bat, I think it's silly, and I think that's why the first one. I think Canadians understand the second one, and that's why that they in their hearts believe the first thing, which is okay, we're not going to get a fair system, so I just have to wait until my guys are in charge and get them to change it in a way that benefits them. The only exception, of course, is the Conservatives essentially already have that system, and so they're entrenched in the status quo, and the Liberals arguably have more to lose than to gain. I don't know. Back to you, Stephen.
Yeah, I think the Liberals with a ranked ballot would have a little more to gain, but Liberals are already doing pretty well. I would push back on the question of whether a majority of Canadians actually want that. I would definitely agree the majority of politicians want that.
And to the extent that I just mean is that, like, I mean, if you ask them, like, do you want a system that benefits you? Like, if you ask them that question flat out, they wouldn't say yes. Where I'm sort of coming from with that is a little bit more nuanced in that, essentially, you know, everybody thinks that their position is right. And so there's this general sense, I think, and you know, we often accuse the right of this, but I think everybody's equally guilty of this, which is, well, my position is right. Therefore, as long as we get the thing that's right and that will ultimately benefit everybody, how I get to get that policy that I believe is correct doesn't matter, because when I get it, it's going to be so good that everyone's going to thank me. I mean, that's essentially, like, we're looking at is essentially Donald Trump's entire argument has really been a subtext in politics for quite a long time. He's just so brazen that he comes out and says it out loud. But I really do think that that's how people think.
But what's I think different and a little frustrating is that all political parties currently admit that first-past-the-post system is flawed. All parties admit that we're not doing it the right way now. And so the lack of political will to change it is perhaps one of the – it's one of the most frustrating things about this whole scenario. But just to wrap up this short piece is that what we're trying to do, what I'm trying to do a little more on the show, is provide ways that, you know, you want to talk about how we can be the resistance or how we can resist sort of this, you know, this push, especially from Trump and but even also here at home against all of the, you know, sort of different sadnesses. The first one seems pretty obvious to me is support this push for proportional representation, or at least get a push against the first-past-the-post system. And there's a bunch of different organizations working on that system, working out to do that. Lead Now is a pretty good one. They've been sort of on that beat since really even before Harper was out of power. And this was a chance. So this, I think this remains an opportunity to hold the liberals accountable. Now, I think that the liberals' lack of political will currently speaks volumes to what we might see in a couple of years. But I think if you got a minority government in a couple of years, you actually could see some electoral reform. And I think following either Lead Now or any whoever you want who's pushing to change our current voting system is a good way to begin to bring some checks and balances back into our own political system as we're watching them get basically squashed in the United States.
Yeah, and I think the last thing that we can predict fairly conclusively on that is that regardless of, you know, who gets elected next time, the opposition parties, and particularly the conservatives, are going to use this to attack Trudeau, even though they're simultaneously happy that changes were not made under Trudeau. So like, oh, look, here's another failed campaign promise. You know, Canadians want electoral reform will be an attack ad, even if they would have preferred that he not do it.
I'll be interesting. This, again, leads to another question of, you know, if the conservatives run Michael Chong, they actually can run a we want electoral reform because he's been on that beat for a while. If they run basically anybody else, yeah, then you're basically looking like, hey, we're the poster child for why you don't want why you might want electoral reform before we get in power again, especially if it's O'Leary or Leach. But anyways, moving on. To the sort of other half of this. So the first half is sort of how we can resist. I've gotten mildly obsessed with this term that I randomly heard recently, which is the resistance and the revolution. And the resistance is sort of stopping what's happening right now, and the revolution is building the future that's better. And so to move from the resistance to the revolution, storage, which I think no one has ever said as excited as I just did. Battery storage is booming. And we had a brief story on this a couple of weeks ago, but I'm bringing it back. That was when Tesla announced its large it turned on its gigafactory. But this is another story coming out of Bloomberg that sort of speaks of not only just that large factory that is being built by Tesla, but expands that to two other massive battery storage plants, one built by AES Corp and one by Alta Gas Limited. Clearly, neither of those two realize that having a cool name for your business is a good idea, like Tesla did. But although perhaps, you know, they're trying to be more sort of behind the scenes kind of thing. But all three storage plants were basically all got built in the almost at the exact same time, and are all at least going live in Southern California at the same time. And to give the sense of scale, this is like a kind of thing that the sense of scale is important here, because any one of these three battery facilities would have been the largest battery storage facility ever built. So all three and all three combined amount to 15% of the battery storage installed planet-wide last year. So just these three power plants. That's how big this actually is. And then the conversation here is actually that, you know, as we've always mentioned, the huge sort of little piece that everyone, like the holy grail, I guess, of a clean energy grid is this conversation. The holy grail of this clean energy grid is this question of can we get storage and solar or storage and wind to match parity, price parity with coal or natural gas or whatever you're competing with. And the biggest part of the big reason for that is if you can get it to match, you can start shutting down perhaps some of the hardest power plants to get rid of, which are these sort of peak natural gas plants. These are natural gas plants that get fired up only when energy demand is at its highest. And so right now, and they act as that sort of buffer. And because it's because natural gas is the easiest sort of turn on and off. You know, it's a little switch basically.
All right.
Versus some of the other renewable energy, which you can't do that same sort of stuff with. You know, hydro has a relatively base power. You can sort of switch hydro a little bit, but wind and solar, especially without storage, just happen or it doesn't happen. You can't make the wind blow. But if you can bring price parity to storage, then you start really disrupting the system.
Yeah, and I would add to that, just like not even as a contradiction, but as an addition too. I mean, that is absolutely critical when it comes to battery, but it's also not the only way to make renewables sustainable. When you have a proper audit done of the available resources, you can gear things such that they overlap. So, for instance, if you have just really quickly, so if you have say 1 gigawatt of electricity from a current power region. It, based on current average technology, those things, there's vast areas for improvement with efficiency. So say you do a bunch of efficiency upgrades and you now knock the needed power down to 80% of that, let's say, right? So then you have, it turns out, well, there's some geothermal opportunities here. So now we build a bunch of geothermal. That does not require the wind to blow and does not require the sun to shine. And then you overlap the solar with the wind. Now, well, generally, not always, but generally speaking, when the wind isn't blowing, the sun is shining and vice versa. Not always, but generally speaking, those two things happen to some degree to have overlap. So, I mean, now the number just keeps coming down and coming down and coming down and coming down, and every single one of those things saves you money in the long term. So there's no, yes, there is a high initial cost, but this can do nothing but go down. And what's better is that when you do a variety of smaller technologies rather than one big scale technology, which I don't know, there might be some animated video somewhere about that on our website called Climate Cartoons, where we recently talked about this. But it means that by diversifying smaller sources and overlapping a variety of things, it also means that you can slowly scale them up, right? So, I mean, we've seen over the last 3 years, the price per kilowatt hour for battery technology has gone from $599, basically $600, down to $275. That's more than a half drop in the last 4 years. And as this technology continues to rapidly be scaled up, when you do a bunch of smaller installations rather than one big one, you can also trade them up as the technology gets better. So I just wanted to underline that is batteries are critical, but they're also not the only thing.
But, well, especially I think batteries are critical not just for the electricity grid, but even more importantly for cars. Cheap battery storage, and that's actually what's driving the cost down to some extent, is Tesla's own demand. Tesla basically is demanding itself to build more batteries, which is then allowing it to scale at a place where it can reduce its own demand. It's sort of self-requiring itself to reduce its own cost.
It's basically just using market mechanisms. So because more people are willing to buy Tesla cars, therefore they have more money to invest on like technology to create storage for those cars.
Yeah.
So I think another main reason for batteries and renewable energy is that we haven't really – right now there's a boom in investment, but before we didn't really see investment in this type of energy. And now that we're going to see it more and more, there's going to be economies of scale at play so that – A lot more people are going to be able to get this stuff for cheaper.
Yeah, exactly. The economies of scale are very important for both solar and also actually for batteries. And to give a sense of just how much scale this is actually we refer to, California is mandating that its utilities begin testing batteries by adding more than 1.32 gigawatts by 2020. So it's 1.2. So that's a fair amount of power. But for context. In 2016, the global market for storage everywhere was less than a gigawatt. So this means that that's the level of scale that we're already even talking about. That's already doubling the demand even in just next 4 years. That's just California's adding the entire demand of this year over the next 4 years. But even that goal is dwarfed by Tesla's own goal, which is to deliver by itself 15 gigawatt hours of battery storage by the year 2020. These goals are scaling. And just to give an understanding of what 15 gigawatt hours of battery storage a year means, it's enough to provide several nuclear power plants worth of electricity to the grid during peak hours. So it's huge. Now, still, you have to actually generate that electricity, which is why you need a massive scale out of solar and wind to actually provide energy to those battery systems. But that's the amount of scale that we're talking about we're going to see in the next 4 years. And the scale is so much so that there's discussions of the possibility that by 2020, this impact and in the increase of electric vehicles because of this massive decrease of price of batteries could actually stop the growth of oil consumption by 2020. We might hit peak oil by 2020, some analysts are now saying, not because we're going to run out of oil, but because we're going to run out of demand, which, you know, throws a lot of our other questions about pipelines into the sort of the fire. But before I throw it to Darren to bring us to our music break, I want to quote the Tesla chief technology officer, J.B. Strubel. Probably Strubel. It's more fun to say Strubel, so let's say it's Strubel. Although if he wants to call on our show to correct me, I'm more than happy to have the Tesla's chief technology officer on hand. But what I like about this one line is that it's one of the things that we sort of are frustrated constantly. And interestingly, it's also one thing that Tesla itself has been criticized for, which is the incredible pace which they and expectations they place on their workers to work basically all the time. It sounds like one of the most interesting, but also one of the most incredibly taxing. And, you know, Musk sounds like a bit of a jerk to his employees most of the time. But what's interesting about that is that we constantly talk here about the speed at which we need this transition. And this quote from J.B. Strubel. Is that what they're doing now and how they're building these factories and how they're building up the storage capacity, quote, it feels like the kind of pace we need to change the world. To some extent, we talk about what a World War II effort looks like in terms of changing our infrastructure, and it looks like this kind of work. It looks like this kind of speed. Little bit of maybe hope. Buy a power wall or, you know, maybe don't buy from Tesla directly. Buy it from somebody else, or just understand that storage is really cool and massively important. And if you want to sort of help the world while dealing with the fact that Trump is still existing, those are two ways. Support Lead Now and buy a bigger battery. I'm going to throw over to Megan, one of our techs for today, to introduce what the next song is.
So for our first music, Blake, we're going to be listening to...
All right, we are back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, one of our wonderful and very appreciated community radio partners across the country, now into the United States and internationally as well, are one of our wonderful co-media folks who help promote the show, National Observer, Rabble.ca. I was recently named, to my surprise, in an article on Vice. They don't host. They didn't know they were hosting us, but they said Green Majority. So thanks for that, Ryan O'Connor. and the podcast. Don't forget about that. Today it's going to be just Spina and I. And I feel like I'm saving my my Trudeau directed vitriol for the bonus show today. So don't worry. I haven't gone crazy. I'm just saving that. You'll have to listen to the bonus show for that. And actually, it comes with a congratulations today. He did a couple things I liked this week. We'll say that.
That's true.
I'm covering tech. I'm in the studio here. I can't entirely see you guys in the other room super clearly. So if you want to jump in, just do that. but here's what we're going to do. So I have two stories. We haven't talked about Monsanto in a real long time. And Monsanto is kind of interesting because... it's saying the word Monsanto is kind of like walking into a university and saying the word GMO for the same reason, in many cases, which is that, lots of emotion, lots of people have really strong feelings right away. I also despise Monsanto, but I think it's really important to just, to be clear about what we disagree with and why. So here's a good example. So, in the news this week, court rules against Monsanto allowing California to put cancer warnings on Roundup, which is one of their lead products. Monsanto, this is a weed killer, and it's sold in more than 160 countries for more than 250 different varieties of crops. It was labeled as a possible cancer threat, despite the insistence from Monsanto that does not pose any risk, that was no risk to people. That's going to be very interesting. I want you to remember that phrase right there, no risk. We're going to come back to that in a second. So it's also important to note that this is a tentative judgment. It has not been 100% confirmed. I'm not entirely sure what a tentative judgment means. I mean, aside from literally, but I don't know how that fits into law in the U.S., but it's probably tentative. I'm tentatively sure I know what that means. It would be the first state in the United States, and Monsanto had in the past sued California based on their decision to do this, based on the International Health Organization based in France. Now, part of their argument is that the International Agency is a French-based branch of the UN World Health Organization, and the Monsanto, however, contends that California is delegating authority to this unelected foreign body with no accountability to the U.S., called the United Nations. technically true, I suppose, if that's where you want to go with that. Now, the chemical is not restricted currently under U.S. EPA law, and I don't think that will change despite this news article, which lists it as low toxicity. Okay, so the chemical company says that it has no risk. The U.S. EPA says it has low risk, which for definition means that it recommends people avoid entering coming into contact with material that has been sprayed with this chemical for 12 hours. See, when I thought of low toxicity, I was thinking of like my shampoo, because it makes my hair feel nice, but if it gets in my eyes, it stings a little bit. That, to me, that's low toxicity. not touching it for 12 hours ever seems like a misnomer to me. But anyway, this organization, again, is France-based International Agency for Research on Cancer. It's based in Lyon, France, and they have identified it as a probable human carcinogen. Attorneys in California, and I would have to agree, consider this organization the gold standard for identifying carcinogens and rely on their findings. Not only do several other states, the federal government itself, again, maybe not anymore, but several other countries. Sabina, go ahead.
Okay, so as a chemist, I also know that a lot of these testings, like toxicological testing, is only for acute exposure. So they say glyphosate, which is like what Roundup is, they say that the way that they measure its toxicity has nothing to do with inhaled like exposure of it for a long period of time, which is for sure going to cause, like for me, it's an organophosphate, and it's definitely going to cause cancer in most people. But when they test the exposure of it, they say only if you touch it or if you come into contact with it, not the fact that it can be an environmental pollutant, which then it's not only where it is or in the agricultural communities, it's also pretty much in our environment, in our soil, in our water, and it has carcinogenic traits. So I think glyphosate, because it's used so much, like you said, it's 167 countries.
160, yeah.
Yeah, 160. So because it's used so much, there's such an abundance of it in our environment that we should really take care to say that this is low risk and low toxicity or no risk or whatever, because it's really untrue. And another thing is that for pesticides, children are specifically more affected than adults. So we're going to have like a whole generation of children that are being raised that have either have come in contact with endocrine disrupting pesticides or carcinogens, where you don't see the effect until later on in life, and there's like low fertility, reproduction problems, or cancers. So I think these are like, these chemical companies should really think before they say low risk or no toxicity warnings on there.
Remind me, is endocrine disruptors the ones that
it affects your hormone system? So it could be either neurobehavioral. You can get something as I guess low risk as ADD, or something as like leukemia or a brain tumor or like reproductive issues.
Yeah, see, that's funny, because I heard that Alex Jones is really concerned about the government feminizing people, and the Republicans seem to be really against LGBT LGBT rights. Right. So you'd think they'd have a problem with that. I mean, I don't. Let's be clear. I obviously don't. Self-interest. But you'd think they would have a problem with that. So here's where the rubber meets the road, as they say. So I'm now quoting directly from the article. Terry McCall believes a warning would have been saved her husband, Jack, who has toted a backpack for of Roundup for more than 30 years to spray weeds on a 20-acre avocado and apple farm. Let's go back to the beginning of the article. Don't come into contact with it for 12 hours. For 30 years, he was wearing a backpack with this. I'm pretty sure some got on him. Now, he died of cancer in late 2015. That does not, absolutely, and Sabina will back me up here, this is a correlation, not causation. No conclusion can be drawn from that. But I think what's really interesting is another farmer they spoke to, Paul Bentecourt, who says he's been using Roundup for more than 3 decades on his almond and cotton crops and says he doesn't know anyone who's gotten sick from it. Also not relevant. Aside from the fact that it's hard to not come in contact with it when you're doing it. But here's a really great quote. So you've got to treat this stuff with a level of respect like anything else, he says. Gasoline will cause cancer if you bathe in the stuff. I also wouldn't consider gasoline low toxicity. Just saying. All right. So really quick history lesson on who are we talking about? Because, I mean, this is really where the rubber meets the road when it hits Trump, right? Trump wants to get rid of regulations and says that this would be good for business. It probably will be, as long as you're not in the insuring people's healthcare business. Because aside from the fact that there has been a well-documented revolving door between Monsanto and the agencies which are meant to review them. But just a little bit of a history lesson. Monsanto also operated the Dayton Project and later Mound Laboratories, which assisted development in first nuclear weapons. They also began manufacturing DDT, which then also they produced PCBs. They also produced Agent Orange during the Vietnam War. This is what we talk about when I bring up things like the amorality of the corporate structure. The example I wanted to use was something around nanites, right? This was a very popular 90s sort of, like, it was the 90s zombies thing, right? It was nanites. Nanoscale robots self-replicating, and they said the very simple version that's used in sort of like late 90s horror movies is that, or science fiction, essentially was that, so you say we have too much carbon in the atmosphere, so someone says, haha, I'm going to make nanoscale self-replicating robots that convert carbon to gold. We're going to take something we don't need or we have too much of, and we're going to turn it into something valuable. What could go wrong? The problem is that, like corporations, like mindless corporations whose sole directive is to maximize profit, these carbon maximizing nanites have no thought process. They simply perform their basic function, which is to convert carbon to gold. Guess what? At some point, we require carbon. There's a whole bunch of carbon in our bodies. You might say we're carbon-based life forms. Now, of course, it's getting into silly territory here, but the analogy stands. We have organizations whose sole interest and sole requirement is to maximize their profit and their influence. That's how you get companies that, oh, by the way, they're also the sole producer for the United States of white phosphorus, which is a military and really nasty, essentially super napalm, is that their single goal is to maximize their profit. And when you have Trump, what you're essentially doing is, aha, I'm going to take some nanites, and I hear that in the future this could be some problem, but I don't believe it, so I'm going to actively, like, spread them everywhere. Like, you're increasing the problem. You cannot win by taking someone whose sole responsibility is to help themselves, give them power, and say that that is going to ultimately help us. That is to significantly misunderstand how corporations operate. The individual people who work there are not relevant in that because they are all slave to that machine. They can quit, but they can't make it do anything other than maximize profit, and that's the problem. So for more on that, you can check the website. The other thing I wanted to get to really quickly, which I'm sure I'm running out of time for, is a corollary to what Stefan was talking about. Paper-thin solar cells could provide power for 1.3 billion people, aside from the fact that solar power itself has declined dramatically over the last few decades. It was about $40 per watt in 1977 and is about 74 cents per watt as recently as 3 years ago. This will allow people who are currently without electricity to plug in for the first time because they can be printed off of relatively cheap industrial printers. Now, relatively cheap means you still need a very significant capital investment, but the actual production of which, once these investments have been made, is very low and is going down very quickly. So a 10 by 10 centimeter solar cell of this film is enough to generate as much as a 10 to 50 watt per square meter panel. And they, because they're flexible, they can be mounted almost anywhere. They can be moved very inexpensively. And this could revolutionize. So this is a good thing and a bad thing. What's the bad thing? Well, the bad thing is, of course, is that without further changes. So say if the only thing we did was flood, China and India with these cells and we did nothing else. Well, all you have now is that, regardless of the fact that it's coming from the sun, you now have a whole bunch of other people who have been brought into the modern world. Great. We want that. We want them to have electricity. The only problem is now they also become consumers. So that is not a single solution, because what you're doing is you're adding new people to be electricity consumers, and you need to now produce all the materials to do all of that. So this technology provides a path to getting off fossil fuels, but without corresponding ways to reduce outside of the market and within the market our dependence on fossil fuels simultaneously, these panels don't get wished into existence. They still consume resources, and they will now, because they're doing what they're intended to do, which is raise the quality of living for these people who are currently without power, which is something we want. But if we don't also take a decrease in other areas elsewhere, perhaps more so than the increase we're going to get, that benefit will be short-lived, as all of us are then suddenly plunged into catastrophic runaway climate change. Stefan, comment?
I think that makes, you know, I think there's, what I love how there's like every one of our rants can end with catastrophic climate change, and it just this is like, this is how that works. This is what we're doing now. Yeah, no, like, what are we doing here? Well, like, how are we going to find a way forward? Like, Sabina, actually, during the break, and I were talking briefly about this idea of how to move forward, and if it really requires a culture shift, or if technology can save us. And I think there's a lot of people out there who are banking on the technology can save us part. And I think that technology will help, but I also think that we're, you know, I think that there needs to be, you know, like, you can 3D print all the solar panels you want. If no one puts them on their house because they're ugly, we're still going to see catastrophic climate change. Yeah. And so I think there's a – I think you could have a whole show, to be honest, about that conversation. But it's – whenever we sort of go through one of these, like, really tech-heavy sections, my other side of my brain says things like, but what about just buying less things? What if we did that?
Hippie.
Exactly, yeah. It's like, it's the economy.
Buy solar panels, Stephen. Yeah.
But it's so often than not, that's the question, right? It's like, is buying – you can't buy your way out of this problem to some extent. You can definitely – that can definitely do a lot of things. But to some extent, there's going to have to be another conversation.
Well, and I started really quickly before – I'll give Samina the last word here. But one of the things that I've been doing – I mean, I've been talking about it for a while. I've actually started to compile. I've sent you a preview copy, Stephen and Sabina as well. But I've added more to the list. It's going to prevent me from continuously bringing things up on the show as far as like my solutions to ideas, because we are in fact going to do a whole show on a bunch of policies. We may not agree on all these, but we're going to kick them around a little bit, and they will be posted on our website, which is that a lot of the trouble with discussing these issues and the trouble with doing it in the format of a radio show or a podcast, wherever you may be listening, is excellent because it's long format, but it's not nearly long format enough to make up for, say, a university degree. And to really understand these issues, you need several university degrees to really have a complete understanding of it. We've done our best with our singular university degrees and spending, you know, decade plus reading the news and doing independent research, but even still, I mean, we're barely experts.
I want to point out that Sabina almost has two.
Well, so she's winning.
It's doubling our
but
efforts,
no
really.
Yeah.
Not nearly as much experience sass talking, but far better educated. but I mean, the point here is that you know, it's very easy to take any portion of the show or even this entire show and say, aha, well, yes, but if you factor in X, Y, and Z with the market, blah, 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 blah. It's very easy to come up with sort of shoot from the hip or rapid fire, seemingly problematic issues with any point of view in any format like this. But what we all really need to understand is that all of these problems are connected. They're all interlocking pieces. And so you can't just pull one of them out of the puzzle and say, aha, I've solved this problem. And this is really what we're talking about here. And I think, well, basically, I can predict the rest of the shows for 2017. It's all going to be holistic change in the sense that you have to change a whole bunch of things to get anything else to do it. It's the same exact thing we were just talking about a minute ago with the proportional representation, right? How do you get a power that got elected under one system to change the system to another one that is more fair and theoretically, in most cases, would be less likely to elect them, or at least them as strongly as previously? You need a more fundamental change than simply voting in liberals and saying, please do the best for all of us because, you know, we have complete naivete about how politics works. You really need holistic solutions. So we will be doing that. And that also means that I'm going to go on slightly less rants about these individual points on the individual shows until we do that show, because we're going to deal with that in a holistic fashion at some point. And then from that point forward, I will simply be able to refer back to those list of suggested policies because they will be posted on the website. So stay tuned for that. We're going to now in a minute go to our second and final music break. And we're back. You're listening to the final section here on the Green Majority Radio, CIET 89.5 FM. Our wonderful and very appreciated community radio partners internationally, as well as Rabble.ca, National Observer, Vice, and Bugs Bunny. just threw that in there in case anyone's asleep. Sabina is now in charge of our final section. Please take it away, Sabina.
Thank you. So I kind of wanted to go back to what you were saying about before I get into the stories, I wanted to go back to what you were saying on the holistic and how interconnected all of these issues are. And I really wish I didn't sound like such a hippie all the time. Like when I'm trying to make a scientific point and then I'm like, but man, it's all connected.
It's all connected.
Because it really is. But I think that people find it really, really scary to try to tackle something as large as like holistic change and a fundamental shift in change when they can just say, oh, look, but this technology can just make your greenhouse gas reductions like less than 20, like by, it can reduce them by 25%. It just makes so much easier to reduce things by 25% than to completely change who you are and the way that you do business and the way that our society works.
Well, I just think it's worth noting, Sabina, not only are you quantifiably the most educated person in this room, but of the three of us, you're the only one of us on the hippie note who does not currently need a haircut. So I just thought that you should have that.
Maybe I do need one. Okay, so for the news for today, I'm going to talk a little bit more about agriculture because it's kind of become an obsession of mine as of late, and then a little bit on Canadian scientists and U.S. scientists. So for news south of the border, President Donald Trump, and I can't believe I'm still saying that at all, but has nominated Sonny Perdue, a former Georgia governor and the current head of an agribusiness trading company, as his agricultural secretary. So a little quick background on Perdue. As a Georgia governor, I'm quoting from the article from The Guardian at the moment. So as a Georgia governor from 2003 to 2011, he has supported factory farm expansion, so that's going to piss off every vegan ever, cracked down on immigration and opposed air quality regulations, so that pretty much, so anybody that believes in anything is already pissed off by this guy. So he famously also thought that the best tactic for a state suffering from drought was a prayer vigil. And then at a time when food systems contribute as much as 25% of global greenhouse gases, he joins the growing rank of cabinet nominees that deny climate change, saying that it's a running joke and liberals have lost all credibility. So this is now the head of agriculture in the U.S. And agriculture, as I'm going to reiterate, is one of the biggest greenhouse gas emitters. And also we need it for food security and to live. So moving on from that. So Trump's decision was, of course, widely applauded by the National Chicken Council, the Cattlemen's Beef Association, as well as the Farm Bureau Federation. And they praised Perdue for his credibility to make American agriculture great again. Yes. And so great again for who, first of all? So and the whole ethos, if I may, of Trump's Make America Great Again is to, quote unquote, bring the power back to the people. And his choice in Sonny Perdue as an agricultural minister is quite questionable to that, because right now Sonny is more focused on large-scale agriculture, specifically monoculture, and with the main goal of export and trade. And this will literally only benefit 4% of the farmers in the U.S., and the rest of the 96% are middle-class farmers that rely on agriculture or rely on giving agriculture to the American people. The basics of trade theory is basically that the only people or the only farms or firms that can trade in trade theory are the most productive firms. And this goes back to increasing productivity, increasing efficiency, increasing money. But when you have monoculture and when you have a farm, like large farms that whose main point is to trade, that means that you're not really, not only are you not giving sustenance to the people in your country, you're only benefiting the 4% that are efficient enough and productive enough to trade.
I just wanted to also remind people as well that, as far as, you know, quote unquote right wing goes, pull your stuff up by your bootstraps and we can't be subsidizing things and we have to make sure that industry is maximizing because, you know, profit is, you know, that is the best way to, you know, trickle down and all these buzzwords. I'm sure we can all guess what the two of the most heavily subsidized industries in the planet are is agriculture and fossil fuels. Congratulations, bootstraps.
Exactly. And I think it's this is really where it all, like, why it's so difficult to make any of these changes is because when you have like large powers like this, or even these National Chicken Council, or the Cattlemen's Beef Association, or the Federation of Agriculture, or Farm Bureau Federation, these are very large unionized, very. I'm not sure.
I'm almost certainly not unionized.
Sorry, I'm sorry.
No, largely just because of how often migrant labor is used within
yes,
agriculture.
True.
I'd be shocked if they were effectively unionized. Now there might be some. It's definitely an organization of farmers.
Yeah.
But I would be very, very surprised if at least some of them are unionized.
That's why I corrected myself, because I actually wasn't sure on that unionized thing. But it's still very, very powerful. And so for me, my main concern of why this is an issue of only having monoculture like soy, wheat, or corn growing in the U.S. is this increases, first of all, the use of glyphosate, like Roundup Ready. So it increases the use of pesticides. It reduces soil fertility. It increases the resilience of pests, because one pest can basically effectively destroy the entire crop, because it's only one crop. So if a resilient enough pest is introduced to this crop, which is what would happen if climate change is to occur at the rate that it's occurring right now, not only does this not provide sustainable food production for American people, but it's also just not a sustainable way to continue food production at all. And if you're only focusing on exporting these very large, like soy and corn, you're not really increasing biodiversity in the area, which means that there's a lot of problems that come with that as well.
I'll just jump in on the corn thing. More often than the corn subsidies in the United States are ludicrous. One of the frustrations I have with this whole Trump thing is basically that like there are so many real problems that the United States has to fix, and now we're just trying to preserve what exists, even when things like the corn subsidies are basically just giving, and they're pitched as a way to help the middle class farmer people, where in reality what they're actually doing is just massively subsidizing large like Coca-Cola and Pepsi, because they basically drive down cost of corn so much that then that's why corn is now in everything. Like if you ever look for glucose, fructose, or anything like that, that's corn, which has been used as a sweetener because corn is so cheap that it's cheaper now to get sugar out of corn rather than to use actual sugar, and it's way cheaper.
Yeah, and I mean, just to have to come back to this because it's so perfect. The thing of the subsidies is so ludicrous, right? Subsidies generally, like subsidies are used in many cases. In theory, the way they're supposed to be used is it's a public good that is so beneficial that it's worth it for the government, which is the combined purchasing power of taxpayers, that it's in everyone's benefit to provide the producer of that thing that's so incredibly necessary with some upfront advantages, such that it's lowered for those consumers. In theory, those subsidies should produce better cost gains than what you give them. So if taxpayers put together $5 million in subsidy, in theory, this should produce more than $5 million in savings. That is the theory behind it. But in practice, how this works is it also entrenches existing companies. And so these existing companies go ahead and take advantage of all those subsidies, all the soft drink companies, all the food producing companies, as far as the corn specifically, as you were mentioning, the corn syrup, all the fossil fuel, all the resource extraction, basically all of the entrenched technologies. And guess who owns the vast majority of those companies? Giant right-wingers who donate to right-wing organizations who try and prevent who try and lower taxes on the rich and try and fund climate denial and try and prevent new technologies from breaking through. Who are these new technologies usually done by? This is generally done by Silicon Valley and by small startups. These are the people who actually need subsidies, and they're being prevented by it by people that already have subsidies so that they can keep their money. And I'm really confused how any right-winger out there thinks that they're the beneficiary of this arrangement. Please, if you have an argument for why this is ultimately in everyone's best interests to prevent advances in technology and from preventing technologies that will lower costs and improve our benefits as far as the actual products themselves, which is theoretically the outcome, right, is to save people money and to provide greater benefit to the public, I'm all ears. Our phone number and email is listed on the website. Come at me, bro.
Well, just quickly, just on the comment of the purpose of these subsidies in particular, I think are more actually meant to save or to help small farmers and farmers. The difficulty is that when they build them, they do it by amount. And so most of the subsidies go to the – instead of, I would say, by doing it by farm or by owner, they do it by amount produced, which means that most subsidies go to this massive producers, which then supports monoculture, then supports – you know, it's an inherently flawed system that works to only encourage larger and larger farms to be used by fewer and fewer people. They could provide the same subsidies, but with requirements to diversify their yields, then you have a whole different conversation. But sorry, Sabina.
No, I mean exactly what I was going to say next, and this article also pretty much nails it. And they say that we can also expect Purdue's USDA to slash incentives for conservation on farms that safeguard land and keep water viable for future generations. We can expect them to ignore worker demands for better wages and protection. And also, he has very close ties to Coca-Cola, which raises flags. Exactly. So it raises flags for public health. And the U.S. already has a huge problem with obesity and really malnutrition. I'm not going to say malnutrition is what we imagine it like in those, you know, NGO commercials of children in Africa. But malnutrition is also when you just don't have enough nutrients to live a healthy life. And all of these packaged, prepackaged, like soft drinks or foods, those are in a way malnutrition, and which is why we're seeing a rise in non-communicable diseases such as obesity
Yeah, you can eat a Big Mac, you know, seven times a day. You're still malnutritious, or you're still not getting the nutrition you need, which provides malnutrition because most of that isn't food. It's edible, but I wouldn't call it food.
Exactly. And so, and lastly, to end it, to end this article on climate change, because that's the key point that connects all of it. As we start to see the impacts of climate change, it increases the pests. And this will be a large issue for smallholder farmers, especially because our smallholder farmers in America and around the world. But this because they are the ones that rely on the ecosystem the most, and an increase in pests will actually affect them the most, more than large scale farms. And as well as monoculture is largely unsustainable and has a very has just a lot of unsustainable practices and a lot of issues for soil, water, and air. And so to move on from agriculture and unsustainable practices, we're going to talk about an article that was just posted as well on The Guardian about Canadian scientists offering support to the U.S., to their U.S. counterparts. So for me, I really, I'm happy to see these kinds of things, but I'm really, really sad to see that there is essentially going to be a muzzling of U.S. scientists, and it's science that's been backing up all of the facts and all of the figures on climate change and on protecting our environment. So when you start to introduce, quote unquote, the alternative facts and start to have people full of climate change deniers, and it really, really demotivates everybody around them. So this article basically just says Canadian scientists have been making contact with their counterparts in the U.S. in order to offer their support and solidarity amid mounting fears that Donald Trump's presidency will seek to suppress climate science. I don't know if you guys have any opinions on this, or
it is interesting that how quickly that the similarities started coming across in the, you know, from Harper to Trump, and I think you learn, I guess, how to combat it to some extent. You know, the scientists actually arguably were very, very effective in combating Harper here. I'd be interested. I think it'd be very valuable information they could provide of sort of, you know, how to resist, in what ways are useful to resist. And because there's certainly all layers of government bureaucracy that, you know, that you have to sort of figure out your way through to do. And so I think this idea of cross-border, like almost even like it gets better sort of campaign. You know, it's like, yes, like it's going to be a scary time. We went through it as well. And, you know, we have our issues with Trudeau, obviously, but, you know, he did at least unmuzzle the scientists. And so to some extent, you know, like you know, any government that's scared of science is probably government you should be scared of. And so it's good to see that sort of science, like, which no one ever really, I would never thought scientists would be a block of people that would be like in a political sphere, but clearly it's becoming one, and it's good that they're standing together.
All right, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening to The Green Majority here live, CIUT 89.5, or on one of our wonderful partners. Check out the podcast for the bonus show where Sabina will be joining me in just a minute. But if you're on the radio, check out the website, and we will see you later. Have a good green week, folks, and take care.